Greetings and jocculatory bibulations, my narco-protically trilaginous listeners, and welcome to this April 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this improbably draconic science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. All right, how in the heck is it April already? I just don't get it. I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I'm going to say it again. Why does it seem like every year goes by faster the older you get? Well, I may have an answer for you. Yes, our first story of the night suggests why time seems to go more swiftly as you age. It is only a theory, but it seems to be a pretty good one. As I mentioned, looking at the date and realizing we're now almost a quarter of the way through the year, when the holidays seem like just last week, can leave you pretty dumbfounded. Where'd all the time go? And why do the days seem so much shorter than they did when we were younger? Well, according to Dr. Adrian Bajan of Duke University, time is not moving faster. The days are not getting shorter. However, as we age, things only seem to be moving faster because our aging brains are obtaining and processing images much slower than when we were young. Bajan says, quote, "People are often amazed at how they remember days in their youth that seemed to last forever and how those days are now gone. It's not that their experiences were much deeper or more meaningful. It's just that they were being processed in rapid fire," unquote. He suggests that as we grow older, our nerves, our neurons, also grow, meaning signals must travel further along those pathways, and they take longer to get to where they're going. These pathways are also degrading as we age, so the signals are experiencing more resistance. Those two factors lead to a decreased rate of acquisition and processing of mental images, resulting in the feeling that time is passing more quickly because we cannot view the same volume of images in the same amount of time as we did when we were younger. This is evidenced in why babies move their eyes around so frequently. They're processing images much quicker and so move their eyes more frequently to gain more information. Bajan adds, quote, "The human mind senses time changing when the perceived images change. The present is different from the past because the mental viewing has changed, not because somebody's clock rings. Days seem to last longer in your youth because the young mind receives more images during one day than the same mind in old age." Unquote. Eugh. Okay, so when I explained all this to my lovely wife, her response was, "What? That makes no sense. Your brain is going slower, but time is moving faster? How does that work? It's completely the opposite of what you'd expect." So it took me a minute to come up with the proper explanation. My first explanation had to do with the flash, at which she rolled her eyes and said, "Seriously?" My darling wife can be quite geeky, but when I start to talk about comic book superheroes, she draws the line. Well, this was my explanation. When the flash is moving at high speed, the whole world slows down around him. Everyone looks like they're moving in slow motion relative to him because he's moving so fast. Not only is he moving fast, but his brain has to work faster in order to keep up with his body, and so again, everything around him is moving so slowly, they may as well be almost frozen. Think about it. The Flash's subjective time has changed and slowed down because he's moving so fast. A day could last a week for him because his movements are so quick. For people around the Flash, the subjective day goes much faster because they are living at a normal slow pace, and there's no apparent extension. The Flash is the young kid with their brain racing. Time slows because their brains are working so quickly. Us older folk are like the pedestrians around the Flash, and our brains are moving slower, so the world seems to go by faster. My wife groaned at that, so I asked, "What about Quicksilver from the X-Men? Remember the movie Days of Future Past?" She did not. And she glared at me for mentioning another superhero. I tried a different track, since I know my wife is a bit of a Trekkie. "Wait, what about classic Star Trek?" I said. "Remember Wink Him and I, that episode? where Kirk is kidnapped, drugged, and forced to live at a rate of incredible acceleration? She did remember that. Same thing. Kirk was accelerated to such a high degree of speed that an hour lasted days to him, but not to the crew for whom a day went faster. And there was my breakthrough. So my question is, do drug addicts who are constantly high on stimulants like cocaine or methamphetamine see time as moving more slowly? Is that an artificial way to make life seem more like it did when you were a kid? Maybe, but I doubt it's worth the price of being a coke addict or a meth head. But it is an interesting question. I also wonder whether caffeine addicts like me get our brains to move faster and the day to move a bit slower by imbibing Diet Coke and gallons of coffee. Well, I think I'll write to Dr. Bajan and see if he has a thought about artificial ways to boost neural speed. Next story. For years, I've advocated that high fructose corn syrup is bad for you because humans just don't digest it very well. And it does seem to promote obesity. Apparently, it's worse than I thought. High fructose corn syrup may be extremely bad for you. How bad, you ask? Well, Dr. Yi-Ye Yun of Baylor College Medicine has shown that consuming even a modest amount of high fructose corn syrup, the primary sweetener in most sugar-sweetened beverages, promotes the growth of intestinal tumors in mouse models, independently to any link with obesity and metabolic syndrome. You also identified the mechanism by which fructose can fuel cancer growth, a finding that could feasibly lead to new therapeutic strategies. Yun is the main author of the paper just published in a March volume of the journal Science. Yun says, quote, "Our study revealed the surprising result that colorectal cancers utilize high fructose corn syrup, the major ingredient in most sugary sodas and many other processed foods, as a fuel to increase rates of tumor growth. While many studies have correlated increased rates of colorectal cancer with diet, this study shows a direct molecular mechanism for the correlation between consumption of sugar and colorectal cancer," unquote. Yun continued with, "Our findings point to an independent relationship between high fructose corn syrup and tumor progression. Our results suggest that when animals have an early stage of tumors in the intestines, which can occur in many young adult humans, by chance and without notice, consuming even modest amounts of high fructose corn syrup in liquid form can boost tumor growth and progression independently of obesity. Our observation might also explain why increased consumption of sweet drinks and other foods with high sugar content during the past 30 years is correlating with an increase in colorectal cancers in 25 to 50-year-olds in the U.S. and other countries," unquote. Yun's team concluded that their results demonstrate that high fructose corn syrup contributes to intestinal tumorigenesis by accelerating sugar breakdown and the de novo process of making fats, de novo lipogenesis. Quote, "High fructose corn syrup in liquid form rapidly increases the levels of fructose and glucose in the intestine and serum, respectively, which allows intestinal tumors to take up these sugars for their growth. Avoiding consuming sugary drinks as much as possible should significantly reduce the availability of sugar in the colon and reduce the induction and growth of tumors," unquote. Whew, next story. Dr. David Glanzman of the University of California believes that memories that trigger defensive reflexes are encoded in RNA molecules, as opposed to the widely believed hypothesis that they are instead encoded in connections within the brain. Both hypotheses have been suggested for decades. Glanzman claims to have chemically isolated the simplest memory a snail can form and transferred it via an injection from one snail to another snail. In order to check this hypothesis, his team initiated a number of electric shocks in sea snails via a wire that had been implanted in their tails. When the snails were then physically prodded with a wire in the aftermath of the shock, their gills contracted, which Glanzman compared to a person being jumpy after experiencing an earthquake. The memory of the event induces an involuntary reflex to loud sounds. RNA was then extracted from the shocked snails and injected into other snails. It was discovered that the injected snails also experienced the same sensitization. When the experiment was repeated with control snails that had wires implanted but were not shocked, the transfer of behavior did not occur. Glanzman believes this is evidence of a transfer of memory between the snails, and that these are held in RNA rather than, again, that connectivity between brain cells. Glanzman says, quote, "What we are talking about are very specific kinds of memories, not the sort that says what happened to me on my fifth birthday or who is president of the United States," unquote. His work has been met with skepticism. Well, a lot of skepticism, including mine. Not only do I think that snail brains are not anything like human brains, I don't believe that information can be transferred from brain to brain in as simple a manner as RNA injection. Yeah, I think they have discovered something, and it's interesting, but I'm not really sure it's what they think it is. It could be hormonal, for example. Glanzman is injecting a soup of stuff into that second snail. He could be hitting on some sort of uncharacterized behavioral switch. Mind you, I mean, the work is cool and imaginative. I'm just not convinced. Onward and upward. More than 50 non-native species have now found their way to the Galapagos Islands, the very isolated Galapagos Islands. And this is almost 10 times more than scientists previously thought. This new report came out in the journal March 28th, in the journal Aquatic Invasions. The study, a joint effort of the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, Williams College, and the Charles Darwin Foundation, documents 53 species of introduced marine animals in this UNESCO World Heritage Site, one of the largest marine protected areas on Earth. Before the study came out, scientists knew about only 5 of these species. The lead author on the paper, Dr. James Carlton, says, quote, "This increase in alien species is a stunning discovery, especially since only a small fraction of the Galapagos Islands was examined in the initial study. This is the greatest reported increase in the recognition of alien species for any tropical marine region in the world," unquote. The Galapagos lie in the equatorial Pacific, about 600 miles west of Ecuador. They were made famous by Charles Darwin when he visited there in 1835. The islands have been long recognized for their remarkable biodiversity, and part of that is because of their isolation. But with their fame, that isolation has gone down and traffic has spiked. In 1938, just over 700 people lived in the Galapagos. Today, more than 25,000 live on the islands, and nearly 250,000 tourists visit every year. Carlton began his study back in 2015 on two of the larger Galapagos Islands, Santa Cruz and Baltra, where he hung settlement plates from docks 1 meter underwater to see what species would grow on them. He also collected samples from mangrove roots, floating docks, and other debris, and scoured the literature for previous records of marine species on the islands. His team documented 48 additional non-native species in the Galapagos. 30 of them were new discoveries that could have survived on the islands for decades under the radar. Another 17 were species scientists already knew lived on the Galapagos, but previously thought were native. Sea squirts, marine worms, and moss animals called bryozoans made up the majority of the non-native species. And it's likely that almost all the non-natives arrived inadvertently in ships from tropical seas around the world. To reduce future invasions, the Galapagos already have one of the most stringent biosecurity programs in the world. International vessels entering the Galapagos Marine Reserve may anchor at only one of the main ports where divers inspect the vessels. If the diver finds any non-native species, the vessel is requested to leave and have its hull cleaned before returning for a second inspection. Next story. So, my family cat, Cammy, is your typical 10-year-old cat. She sleeps most of the time, watches out a window into our backyard for any invading cat part of the time, and demands to be fed the rest of the time. Oh, and she's a pretty good mouser, too. She's tracked down and terminated at least 3 mice in her house with extreme prejudice in the last few years. She does not respond to her name, but will respond to me when I make a high-pitched, whistling, squealing noise when I try to call her over. This is the noise. Which I've been told sounds like a mouse. At this point, you're asking yourself, another tangent? Dude, what does this have to do with anything? Be patient, kind listeners. In the April 4th issue of the journal Science Reports, Dr. Atsuko Saito of the University of Tokyo suggests that domestic cats appear to recognize the familiar sound of their own names and can distinguish them from other words. While dog responses to human behavior and speech have received much attention, researchers are just scratching the surface of human-cat interactions. Research has shown that domestic cats appear to respond to human facial expressions and can distinguish between different human voices. But can cats recognize their own names? Saito says, quote, "I think many cat owners feel that cats know their names or the word food. But until now, there was no scientific evidence to back that up," unquote. So Saito and her colleagues pounced on that research question. They asked cat owners to say 4 nouns of similar length, followed by the cat's name. Cats gradually lost interest with each noun, but then reacted strongly to their names, moving their ears, head, or tail, shifting their hind paw position, or, of course, meowing. The results held up that cats living alone with other cats and at a cat cafe, yes, they have cat cafes in Tokyo, where owners can hang out with cats. And when someone other than the owner said the names, the cats still responded to their names more than to other nouns. One finding did give the team pause. Cat cafe cats almost always reacted to their names and those of other cats living there at the cafe. House cats did so much less frequently. Lots of humans visit cat cafes in Tokyo, and cats' names are frequently called together. So it may be harder for cats to associate their own names with positive reinforcement in those environments. That's what Saito writes in the paper. As for whether or not a cat understands what a name is, well, only the cat knows that. I have my strong doubts about this entire study. My cat has never responded to her name, as far as I can tell, and only to that high-pitched noise that I make. So once again, skeptical here. Okay. Onward and upward. Finally, we have more than just a Denisovan finger! Wahoo! Dr. Vince Viola reported at the American Association of Physical Anthropologists on March 28th that he has discovered in 2 pieces in Siberia's Denisova Cave the first Denisovan skull from these mysterious extinct hominids. Mitochondrial DNA extracted from this skull pegged it as absolutely being Denisovan. Apparently, Viola's presentation was one of several at the meeting that raised new questions about these Neanderthal relatives, including how recently they existed. Previously, they were known only from minimal discoveries in the Denisova cave. Back in 2009, a tiny part of a finger bone yielded Denisovan DNA that proved crucial to identifying that Stone Age population for the first time. Sediment analyses indicate that Denisovans periodically inhabited the Denisova cave from around 300,000 to 50,000 years ago, with Neanderthals reaching the cave after around 200,000 years ago. But little else is known about the Denisovans' evolutionary history, or their identity for that matter. It's long been unclear, for example, if Denisovans belong to a distinct human species, and most researchers say that the new evidence is still not enough to resolve that mystery. Viola, from the University of Toronto compared a digital reconstruction of the skull with corresponding parts of 112 present-day human skulls and 30 Stone Age skulls, including Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. The Denisovan find didn't fit neatly into any previously known human species. Some features link the Denisovan fossils to Neanderthals and to a 430,000-year-old Spanish Homo species that had Denisovan ancestry. The Denisovan skull fragment is apparently surprisingly thick, more like the cranial bones of the Stone Age Homo erectus. Viola says that we may not be looking at a purebred Denisovan skull. Quote, interbreeding of closely related populations such as Denisovans, Neanderthals, and Homo sapiens generates novel skeletal features and can obscure what started out as, say, a distinctive Denisovan look, unquote. Dr. Murray Cox of Massey University in New Zealand also reported at the same meeting that at least three separate Denisovan populations interbred with ancient human populations. Remnants of two of those populations appear in modern Aboriginal groups in Papua New Guinea. People in Papua New Guinea interbred with one genetically distinct Denisovan population around 46,000 years ago. The scientists estimate that people on Papua New Guinea interbred with one genetically distinct Denisovan population around 46,000 years ago. Interbreeding with a second line of Denisovans took place by about 30,000 years ago and possibly as recently as 15,000 years ago. If his study proves to be true, then Cox says, quote, Denisovans were the last surviving hominids who were not Homo sapiens. Those last survivors likely inhabited Papua New Guinea or a nearby island, unquote. For molecular signs of interbreeding with Denisovans, Cox probed about 3,000 DNA samples obtained from around 100 communities on Papua New Guinea and other Southeast Asian islands. The new DNA analysis suggests that some now living on Papua New Guinea and nearby islands carried roughly 400 Denisovan genes involved in immunity and dietary function. Denisovan DNA, previously identified in present-day Siberians, East Asians, and Native Americans, does not occur in island Southeast Asia and thus represents a third Denisovan line. Well, we'll know Denisovans are really important when 23andMe starts to test not just for Neanderthal DNA in your genome, but for Denisovan DNA as well. Okay, the final story of the night. I pretty consistently talk about exoplanets and their discovery on the podcast. This next story is along those lines, but the planet that was discovered was quite different from any of the others previously known. When most planet-hosting stars run out of hydrogen fuel, they blow out their outer shells of gas, obliterating anything within their inner solar systems and leaving behind a dead star called a white dwarf. Planets orbiting farther out can survive this initial cataclysm, but if those planets move closer, they get ripped apart or even gobbled up by the dead star's intense gravity. The April 5th issue of the journal Science reports the rare discovery of an intact planetesimal, as it's called, still orbiting close to the white dwarf SDSS J1-228-1040, and it could offer insight into the fate of solar systems like our own and the chemical makeup of planets. The study was led by Dr. Christopher Manzer at the University of Warwick. He used the Gran Telescopio Canarias in Spain's Canary Islands to peer at the debris disk surrounding the white dwarf over two nights back in spring of 2017, and then three nights last year in spring of 2018. The observations of the dead star, about 400 light-years away, revealed a slight brightening and dimming of certain wavelengths of light in the disk every 2 hours or so. That indicated the presence of a comet-like tail of calcium gas trailing a planetesimal as it whipped around its star. Manzer says, quote, the gaseous jet stream may be generated by the white dwarf's radiation blasting calcium off the planetesimal, or by the planetesimal vaporizing calcium dust as it plows through surrounding rubble. This hardy chunk of rock hugs its star extremely closely, orbiting almost 300 times closer than Earth orbits the Sun. Since it is able to survive the intense gravity without being shredded, the planetesimal is probably a dense, iron-rich object just a few hundred kilometers across, possibly the core of a planet whose outer layers had been stripped away, unquote. Studying this relic and other bits of planetary matter around white dwarfs could help astronomers better understand the composition of planets, something that's hard to do even here on Earth, because you can't simply dig down hundreds or thousands of miles down to the core. Not easy to do. Well, that's all for me for now. Slow your day down with caffeine. Avoid high fructose corn syrup, if only to stay thin. Keep talking to your cat, even if she doesn't know her name. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.